In the coming week, President Biden travels to South Korea and Japan. The 75th World Health Assembly holds crucial meetings in Geneva, and Australians vote in a general election. It's May 19th, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
So, Jim, as we're speaking, President Biden is poised to travel on Air Force One to South Korea and Japan for summits with the South Korean and Japanese leaders in his first presidential trip to Asia. Now, earlier this week, you sat down on your other gig in the podcast world, the President's Inbox, to talk with our colleagues Sheila Smith and Scott Snyder about this trip. Can you give us a sense of what's on the agenda, maybe drawing from that conversation for starters?
Well, Bob, a lot's on the president's agenda. He is clearly number one, trying to show up in Northeast Asia to signal his continued interest in Japan, in South Korea, in the issues affecting East Asia. But I think he's also looking to help move forward what has been pretty remarkable Western, I mean that in a philosophical rather than geographical sense, response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And the president has a pack-filled agenda. He's only going to be in the region for a few days. He starts out in Seoul, as you mentioned, where he is going to meet with the brand new, and I mean brand new, president of South Korea, President Yoon, who succeeded the outgoing president, President Moon. And President Yoon has been in office, I think, for just about 10 or 11 days by the time President Biden arrives. They're going to be talking about a lot of issues. You can imagine what they are. North Korea, China, Ukraine, I think, are going to top the list. They'll probably also be talking about economic issues. And one of the big questions about President Biden's stop in Seoul is whether Pyongyang is going to do something to signal its existence or displeasure. There's been a lot of speculation that North Korea may test a nuclear weapon or test an ICBM or some other kind of missile. So that could be something that happens while the president is in Seoul or at his next stop in Tokyo. In Tokyo, President Biden is going to have an official bilat with the newish prime minister of Japan, Prime Minister Kishida. Now, President Biden has a long working relationship, or a reasonably long working relationship, with Prime Minister Kishida, who used to be Japan's foreign minister. So President Biden, Prime Minister Kishida are going to have a moment. Then we're going to have a meeting of the Quad. Remember, the Quad involves the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. This is going to be the third Quad leaders level summit meeting, the second one taking place in person. You can imagine the topics are going to be pretty similar there, probably leading with China, but also Ukraine. And again, here the issue is going to be that while Australia and Japan have been very forward-leaning in terms of putting pressure on Russia, as we've discussed before, India has not been joining the parade of countries, either criticizing the Russian invasion, and certainly not going to the point of imposing any kind of sanctions, symbolic or otherwise. Indeed, the Indians have gone in the other direction and have been trying to buy and have succeeded in buying cut-rate discounted Russian oil. Final thing that's going to happen while the president is in Tokyo, Bob, is he's expected to unveil the newest version of his Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. It's called IPEF. It was first rolled out in broad brush back in the fall. We get a few more details in February, and now we're expecting to hear the president talk a bit more about it. It's significant because it is the Biden administration's first significant trade initiative. We're now 16, almost 17 months into the Biden administration. My sense is that Tokyo and Seoul and other capitals in East Asia and the Indo-Pacific are not particularly impressed by what the Biden administration is putting on the table. It is not going back to TPP or what is now the CPTPP. It is not a different kind of trade deal that would require congressional approval. It is something that the president hopes to do on his own initiative. And as you know, Bob, if a president can do something on his own initiative, a subsequent president can undo it on his own initiative. So it doesn't really have the ballast, the weight, I think, to really make a big impression on leaders in the Indo-Pacific. And that's going to be the rub, because the Biden administration has signaled all along that countering China is job number one. But so far, it has been primarily leaning on a military response, not developing the other aspect that's going to be significant, which is developing economic ties. And that's clearly why what the countries in the Indo-Pacific want. They want to have access to the American market.
Jim, you touched on that also as we were setting up the ASEAN summit a week ago about that trade angle or the sort of paucity of trade offers.
Yeah, I tend to repeat myself, Bobby.
Well, it bears repeating. And it also seems like the readouts I saw from that summit was there was, you know, the summit, while it achieved some direct personal connections and so forth, was left wanting because of that. And IPEF certainly doesn't have the same resonance that TPP had in the region, although in the United States, TPP is the pact that dare not speak its name, I guess. So, but at the same time, is there any opportunity, though, in this still pandemic-racked world with grave concerns about inflation and global supply chains and so forth, where this trip could still help in these really vital economies in the region in terms of triggering something maybe around the edges or some sort of economic boost of some sort, even if it's a modest one?
The optimist take, Bob, is something is better than nothing, and just showing up in the region is important. Just jumping back for a minute to the ASEAN summit meeting, as we spoke about last week, you're right, no news came out of the meeting, but in some sense, that's good news, because often at meetings, when you get unexpected news, it's not good. It's something troublesome happened, some faux pas, diplomatic or otherwise, occurred, so that didn't happen. I think, again, for President Biden, you know, part of this trip is simply the fact of showing up. It's been commented on in the region that this is President Biden's first trip to Tokyo, first trip to Seoul as president, whereas he's been to Europe 3 times already in his presidency. And as you know, people tend to say, tell me where you travel and I'll tell you who you value. So that's an issue. And again, the administration would point out, and I think senior Japanese officials, senior South Korean officials would say, hey, the president made it a point to have the Japanese prime minister and then the South Korean prime minister at Washington very early on in his presidency. So this is President Biden really trying to reinvigorate American leadership, both regionally and globally. Some of those topics they're going to discuss clearly are going to be regional, the economic ones, China, obviously, but also global. The question of what can be done to counter Russian aggression in Ukraine. How do you deepen that kind of really surprising coordination among countries, not just in Europe, but countries in Europe with countries in the Pacific that are America's friends, partners, and allies. And I think that's going to dominate the conversation. And I'm sure the Biden diplomatic team would say, heck, Rome wasn't built in a day. We're making really good progress. What you should focus on is the direction we're going in, the support we're getting from our friends, partners, and allies. And we'll get there, maybe not as fast as people in think tanks think we should get there, but we will.
Jim, on that front, and particularly about the Quad meeting, is there going to be, or should we look for any kind of awkwardness for the Indian participation in that because of the reasons that you referred to earlier and the fact that India has not been this robust leading democracy, consolidating its approach and shared values with other democracies in the West about standing up to aggression and so forth? Is that going to tarnish in any way, you think, or should we be looking for that at the Quad meeting?
That is certainly going to be a theme running through the conversations, but I wouldn't expect a blow up. I think that President Biden understands that honey beats vinegar. I think he also understands that India has military relationships that go back decades with Russia. It depends upon Russia for parts and the rest. So I think you're going to see more nudging than you're going to see pushing on this issue. But again, for the United States, the U.S.-India relationship is both potentially quite important, but it also has a lot of difficulties built into it. And again, this is just one manifestation of the differences between the two countries. Again, the fact that they agree on some issues doesn't mean that Washington and Delhi agree on all issues. Big divisions on issues related to economics. There are big divisions, again, on how to respond to what has happened with Russia. And then the issue looming over all of this is what many people in the United States see as the erosion of democratic liberties in India, the surge of Indian Hindu nationalism that is crimping the rights or running over the rights of the some 200 million plus Muslims who live in India. And that issue of democracy, human rights is the potential irritant in the relationship. And before I start getting emails and tweets from listeners in India, I will note Indians can point and say American democracy is in trouble, has a tarnished record as well. Not disputing that at all, just acknowledging that this is an irritant in the relationship.
Yeah, and I would just say, interestingly, you had recent leadership changes in Japan and South Korea that were not marked by serious erosion in democracy by all appearances, but in fact were pulled off, you know, rather efficiently and effectively, even though they marked changes in both style and in party power.
Well, they certainly do. And again, I think some of the thinking that is going on in Seoul, in Tokyo, also in New Delhi, is where is American politics going? Is President Biden going to be able to institutionalize his promises? Or do we face the possibility 3 years hence, we're going to see everything President Biden has done get revised or rewritten? And that's why you see a lot of talk, not only about trying to encourage the United States to be interested, involved in the region, but also talk about maybe we should hedge against the possibility that the United States will basically veer off in a different direction, leaving us greatly exposed. Bob, let's switch gears and turn to the 75th World Health Assembly. It is set to meet in Geneva, Switzerland, this coming May 22nd to the 28th. This will be the first World Health Assembly meeting to be held in person since 2019. And of course, the meeting is going to take place against the backdrop of an estimated 15 million COVID-19 deaths worldwide, a million of which happened here in the United States. So what's on the agenda for the WHA, Bob, and what do we think might get accomplished?
Jim, it's COVID certainly is front and center, although it is certainly also not exclusively the issue to go on. But it is worth noting, we are not done with COVID yet. Whether you look just around us in the United States, where there are rising levels in almost every U.S. state at this point, amid very mixed signals coming from authorities dealing with a population that's somewhat exhausted with lockdowns and strictures and so forth. But also globally, we mentioned North Korea just a while ago. North Korea is, by many accounts, dealing with the levels of outbreak and concern that we saw in other countries in 2020, and they don't have any vaccines. They have refused vaccines, and there's a great deal of concern that COVID running through North Korea rampantly not only will have a devastating effect on the population, but also it becomes a ripe laboratory for other variants to emerge, and the world has already been dealing with its share of COVID variants. So COVID is going to be a real focus of concern, perhaps an effort to consolidate approaches on distributing vaccines, especially to spots that haven't had any yet or that have had very few distributed, and there's still too many of those. But then there's the business of the WHO and global health in general, Jim, and it's always, as always, perhaps even more so, there are politics involved. First of all, there's supposed to be the determination of the leadership of the WHO. So who will lead it for the next 5 years? Dr. Tedros of Ethiopia, the first African leader of the WHO, is set to run uncontested for a second term. So that is seen to be something that will be taking place. There are going to be decisions involving potentially suspending Russia from WHO membership because of concerns raised about what it has wrought in its invasion of Ukraine, and whether it's the forced, a displacement of up to 15 million people at this point, or the deliberate bombing of health facilities. 200 at least have been identified as deliberately targeted by Russian forces. Aspects like that could end up closing the WHO office in Russia. The U.S. has requested that Taiwan be allowed to take place as an observer because of its strong performance in health issues and what it sees as being able to contribute in constructively. It had been previously an observer from 2009 to 2016. China opposes that in the current climate against Taiwan. So that's an area that will be coming up very early, actually, on the agenda, Jim, as this meeting kicks off in Geneva. And then the really important question of funding. It still has serious funding challenges, despite all the challenges, whether we start with COVID, but certainly all the other areas involving the spreading of wherewithal, the spreading of vaccines. WHO, for all of its faults and perceived faults, has been effective on child vaccination campaigns, whether it was eradicating smallpox or this ongoing effort to finally snuff out polio. And it continues to need funding for that. It gets about 16% or so of its funding from membership dues. The rest come from donations, including huge donors like the Gates Foundation. And one of the issues with relying on donations is donors get to sort of set agendas, and sometimes set agendas at variance or in ways that can disrupt what are seen as more consensus issues that the WHO should be focusing on. So a lot of issues. It's a very consequential WHA meeting, Jim. And again, COVID will keep attentions focused on it probably more than previous ones. But there's the opportunity for the world to pull together, but also to kind of show anew the divisions that are in play.
Bob, let's dive a bit deeper into what we're seeing happening, or what we think is happening in North Korea. I take your point that the North Korean population has not been vaccinated, though I would be willing to bet that the North Korean political leadership has been vaccinated and probably boosted or double boosted at this time. How bad could things get in North Korea?
Jim, the problem with North Korea, as on many other issues involving humanitarian issues, is sort of news blackout, information blackout, and the limited amount of information. But those organizations, as people who have contacts in North Korea, spell out a wide-scale problem. You even have the leadership of North Korea acknowledging this could be a catastrophe for the country. And on top of COVID, of course, this is a country with a lot of, shall we say, frailty in its institutions, in its taking care of the population writ large. There's concern that not only could we have, you know, COVID outbreak that will overwhelm whatever health systems are in the country, but also famine is a concern. And North Korea has had its bouts with famine, just absolutely horrifying stories, even in recent years, of what it has reduced people to in terms of, you know, where they're getting their calories from, if they can get them at all, and desperate flight of people trying to flee and so forth. So it is as a country, again, almost completely sealed off from the rest of the world, it's hard to find information that can be helpful to the country, but also to be able to bring in things like vaccines, to have some wherewithal and some leeway to open up, you know, the entry of goods and so forth that can get to the people. You mentioned the elite most likely being vaccinated. They also tend to have, you know, control over the influx of any sort of aid and things like that. The UN has had probably more access than any other organization in limited ways to North Korea. And we're going to be looking to the UN, I think, to play a role. China possibly as well. It's not clear. China's got its own COVID concerns as it continues to try to enforce the zero COVID policy there. So they're not eager to kind of sort of open up too much of a cross-border exchange at this point with North Korea. So in answer to your question, Jim, it could get very bad. And we're going to have to sort of follow the normal reports, especially the most reliable ones tend to come from South Korean agencies that monitor the situation there to see what's happening and what can be done.
Yeah, my sense, Bob, is that a lot of experts are worried about compounding problems. Obviously, we know with COVID that it is particularly lethal for people who have pre-existing conditions. And so when you mix a population that may already be unhealthy, suffering from malnutrition, you throw COVID-19 into the mix, it could be a stunning catastrophe. And I think, you know, as you note, the fact that the North Koreans are willing to admit to the world that they have a problem suggests that we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg.
No, that's absolutely true, Jim. And you know, this is a timely development of having the World Health Assembly meet again at this moment of 2+ years of pandemic. The other big issue, I would say, in a related way, is the extent to which China will be speaking up, but also will be facing any sort of scrutiny. There was a recent pretty terse exchange involving China and Dr. Tedros, who was initially facing criticism because he was seen as too compliant towards China. But he has recently spoken out against some of China's approaches to its zero COVID policy and faced pretty strong rebuke from China. You know, it'll be very interesting to see to the extent to which China comes in for criticism or at least calls for greater scrutiny of its practices as the world, again, tries to pull together with a, you know, sort of consensus COVID approach. And what that means for, again, for funding the WHO to take these steps and then to deal with all the other issues on its agenda. And it's, again, aside from COVID, you have rising rates of non-communicable diseases and you have problems of obesity, you have mental health issues that certainly have been spurred on further by pandemic related practices and what the lockdown has wrought in certain countries. So it's just a really packed agenda, Jim. Jim, I want to take our discussion over to Australia, where there will be general elections this Saturday, May 21st. Recent election polling shows current Prime Minister Scott Morrison's Liberal National Coalition is on track to lose to the centre-left Labour Party. They have had some seesawing between those two parties in recent years in Australia, Jim. But what do we need to know about this particular election?
Well, let's begin with some of the basics, Bob. Voters in Australia are going to choose the 151 members of their House of Representatives. That means that the winning party or coalition needs to take 76 seats. Should also note that Australians are going to be voting for 40 of the 76 seats in their Senate. In that respect, the Australian system is similar to the one in the U.S. where you vote for an entire house, but you vote for the Senate in sort of in a staggered way. Now, in Australia, the Constitution requires house elections at least every 3 years. Remember that Australia has a parliamentary system, so prime ministers can call elections early. Right now, a conservative coalition that involves the Liberal Party, which is a dominant partner in the coalition, the National Party, has controlled the government since 2013. And you note that things don't look good for what's called the coalition here in 2022. But the same was said back in 2019. And back then, the coalition pulled off a miracle win. Right now, the coalition controls government by the narrowest of margins. It holds 76 seats, while the center-left Labour Party has has 69. The rest of the seats are held by minor parties and independents. As you know, polls have been showing for weeks that the Labor Party looks to be in the driver's seat. It's likely to take the election. But that margin has shrunk over the last few days. So people are wondering if we're going to have a repeat of 2019. I will note that Australia requires everyone who is 18 years or older to register to vote and also to vote in these elections. So when you're talking about poll results, it's not the same problem you have in the United States where you're trying to determine who will turn out to vote. That isn't an issue in Australia.
Well, they also have the day free, right? They have a free day to be able to do it.
Yes, they do, Bob. I think the Australian Constitution essentially says that voting is both a right and a duty. I should note that Australia has early voting. About a third of the 17 million expected votes have already been cast. What are the big issues in play? Well, as in most countries, the big issues are economic. I think people in Australia, voters are worried about inflation, seeing that worldwide. They're also worried about wage growth and whether it's going to keep up. Now, the Australian economy has done very well over the last several decades and has emerged fairly strongly from the pandemic. But people, you know, when they vote, tend to look not backward to reward people, but forward and looking at what they're worried about. And I think there's some sense in Australia about what the economy holds for Australia going forward. One final thing, just to loop back to where we began our conversation, the big question that's going to be settled by Sunday's vote is who's going to represent Australia at the Quad meeting in Tokyo. Liberal Party leader Scott Morrison, who's 54, has to be planning right now and prepping to go to Tokyo to meet with President Biden, Prime Minister Kishida, and Prime Minister Modi, but he may be turfed out on Sunday. If he is, then Anthony Albanese, 59, is going to become Prime Minister and get to immediately set his sights on going to Tokyo to meet with his fellow Quad leaders.
So either way, it would be useful for, obviously, that meeting to take place and for President Biden to meet the Australian leader, but especially to get a sense of the extremely newly minted leader, as the case may be. But Jim, does it matter if there is a change in leadership in terms of one of the really important emerging storylines coming out of foreign policy in Australia, which is the antagonism with China? Is that likely to change, or are we looking at sort of a consensus at this point amongst the Australian foreign policy establishment?
The answer to that question, Bob, depends upon whom you speak to. If you talk to fervent supporters of the coalition, they would argue that the Labor Party isn't going to take the hard-nosed, realist approach to China that the coalition has taken, and that's a reason, among others, to vote for the coalition. I think what has happened is the Labor Party has sort of tracked Australian sentiment, which has become sharply critical of China and concerned about where China is going. So I think the Labor Party has adopted, at least on paper, stronger policies in dealing with China. So, for example, the Labor Party is not talking about ripping up the AUKUS pact under which the United States will sell nuclear submarine technology to Australia. But many people, again, would argue that the Labor Party is not going to embrace this tougher China line as willingly or as enthusiastically as the coalition has in recent years. But again, you won't know until you know, assuming that Albo, as they call him, becomes prime minister. What choices is he going to make?
Jim, one topic you haven't discussed in relation to these elections is COVID. Australia had pretty severe lockdown strictures in place. They only recently opened up, I believe, to outside travel. Is it playing any role? Is it a consensus that on balance, the government did what it had to do?
Well, it plays a role, Bob, but I think in this election, the economic issues play a far bigger role in sort of shaping where voters go. But of course, it's hard to disentangle this because part of the economic trouble is caused by the fact that COVID has not gone away and has disrupted not just the Australian economy, but the global economy.
Got it.
Bob, we reached that time in our podcast where we talk about our audience figure of the week. Want to remind everybody that listeners can vote on the audience figure of the week or tweet us their suggestions at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected 100,000 missing in Mexico. What does this refer to, Bob?
Jim, this is a figure that is referring to a tally that goes back almost 60 years to 1964, from 1964 to the current day, about the number of people registered as missing or disappeared. So that's registered as missing or disappeared, not overall. That number is actually considered to be even higher than that. But just that round figure speaks to an ongoing area of real concern and failure in Mexican governance. And whether you look at it in terms of the context of fighting the the drug lords and so forth, or some of the other issues that have affected, although a lot of this has been attributed to the drug trade in Mexico, which is still a grave concern. Three quarters of that figure, almost exactly three quarters, are men. And these are men, many of whom were caught up in the drug trade. Of that number, 20,000 of the disappeared have occurred, again, of the registered as missing or disappeared, have occurred in just in the last 2 years. And this is 2 years that of Mexico being run by President López Obrador, AMLO, who had campaigned on a promise to crack down on the issue. And, you know, all sorts of reasons are cited for why Mexico has this problem: corruption in the police, the lack of effective investigations, a sense of impunity if people go missing. Some of the reports that have come out in tandem with this this registering of this 100,000 figure just talk again about the individual human tragedies involved. You know, young men who go out to, you know, to the store one day and never return home, or groups of students on a trip, you know, the infamous trip with the young students who were on a bus trip and then never returned. And there's still an investigation going on into what happened on that. That was several years ago. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, says only 35 cases have led to the conviction of perpetrators. So it gives you a sense of a just both an awful situation and an awful situation about which very little seems to be done.
Any sense, Bob, that the AMLO government is trying to reduce that number, solve the problem?
They speak to their conviction and their intent to solve the problem, but also to the complications that they are running up against, and that it's not something that you crack in a short period of time. I think they spoke about it in ways that might have given hope that they would be much more straightforward and much more thorough in it. But I don't think we're seeing certainly you would imagine the start would be at the level of authorities, whether it's federal or local, where you'd see a real sea change. And from the reports I've seen, you have not seen that yet. And so I'm not sure that there's a great deal of kind of exasperation. Let's see whether this threshold figure being reached in any way stirs more action or not. But I think there's a sense that families do not feel the government is doing enough at this point.
It's a very large number and a very sad story, Bob.
It is indeed. And it's unfortunate that it becomes part of the narrative of Mexico that kind of overshadows other things going on in the country.
Certainly does.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. APEC trade ministers meet in Bangkok. G7 economy and environment ministers meet in Germany. And the French Open, one of tennis's Grand Slam tournaments, gets underway.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Getch and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be careful out there.